your computer's online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for 220K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Leno Sanic. We have on the line Mr. Jim DiEugenio. Hello, Jim.
Good evening, sir.
Pleasure to speak to you again. Thank you for making time for the audience of Black Op Radio. Let's get right to it.
All right. The first thing I want to do, let's go to Kennedy's and King. And I have to say, there's a couple of things that we have up there that I think are kind of interesting and people listening to this program should tune into. First of all, there's the first two parts of a three-part article by a new writer named Max Arvo. I have to tell you, I really advise everyone to read these two articles. Jack Ruby, A Review and Reassessment, Part 1 and Part 2, and we're waiting on Part 3. You will get a really fresh look at the whole thing about what happened to Jack Ruby after he was detained and placed in prison. Okay, now we have that other guy who wrote a book, right? Death to Justice by Paul Abbott. That covers the shooting of Oswald by Ruby. And it's quite good. And we excerpted the introduction and also a sample chapter from Paul Abbott's book. So that covers the shooting, all right? What Max Arvo does is he takes it from the shooting onward. And I have to tell you, there's a lot of new stuff in here that's very, very interesting. You know, this whole accent that people like Mark Shaw placed on Melvin Belli has been misplaced. The key guy, and this is a name that was really kind of rare to me, is a guy named Dr. Hubert Winston Smith. He was a psychologist who thought of this whole psychomotor epilepsy thing before Belli did, all right? And he chose the three psychiatrist panel who examined Ruby. And he's the guy who brought in Jolly West, okay, to do a psychological examination of Ruby. And then Jolly West, of course, was the guy who said that he had gone over the edge, that Ruby was, you know, unstable and imbalanced. And this is a guy who I hardly ever heard of before. So I strongly recommend that everybody read Max's article. It's very, very new and refreshing and interesting. That's why I called it Jack Ruby, A Review and Reassessment. Now, the other one we have is by John Washburn, Mary Bledsoe and the Bus. And what he's doing is he's covering the whole so-called escape of Oswald from the Texas School Book Depository in a new light. And it's an interesting article of the whole thing about, was Oswald really on the McWaters bus? Did he really get into William Whaley's cab? And by the way, he uses materials from the Warren Commission showing it was actually them who said that there was a possibility that Crawford was an impersonator. You know, the guy who worked for Jack Ruby, Larry Crawford, and he quotes Ruth Payne as saying that he did have a resemblance to Oswald. So this is another interesting article. Then I did a review of Four Died Trying, Chapter 2, the Libby Handrows, John Kirby installment. they let me have a private screening of this, okay, although it's not available yet. But this one was called Jack Joins the Revolution, and it's about Kennedy's transformation from about 1951 to 1957 and how he became a whole different side of foreign policy to Eisenhower and Allen Dulles and John Foster Dulles. So I will let you know when that gets posted. It's very much worth seeing. Now, I'm sure you're aware, because you sent it to me, that, well, here, in the news section, which not enough people take a look at. First of all, Kappa is going virtual, and I think it starts Friday? Is it starting Friday?
Yeah, I'll post a link to everything.
Yeah, I think it starts Friday, and this is incredible, because there's so many great people going to be there, and you don't even have to spend $400 for a hotel room or $300 for a plane ticket. You can just watch this at your computer, all right? This is just terrific. I just did one with Steve Jaffe today. We taped it in advance, and ours was about Oswald's alibi. Was Oswald on the sixth floor? And I would have to say it's a resounding no, all right? And now Steve, I wanted to do this with Steve Jaffe. You've had him on a couple of times, haven't you?
Yep, several times over the years.
Yeah, he's coming out with a book, okay, in about 6 months. And it's going to be a memoir of his work with Jim Garrison. And I'm really looking forward to that, because I don't think anybody's ever done that before. I don't think anybody who ever worked for Garrison out of his office ever wrote a book about it. I mean, Lou Ivan, Alvin Osher, Jim Alcock. I don't think any of those people ever wrote a book about their work for Garrison. But Steve Jaffe has. And by the way, he's also the last surviving member of Garrison's staff. So there's some very interesting information that he gave me a preview to, and we managed to go ahead and put it in our talk today. It's really, really, really interesting stuff. Okay. All right. Now, Ethel Kennedy passed away at the age of 96. I think the only person left is Ted Kennedy's first wife, Joan. Okay. Randy Benson's, have you had Randy on lately?
No, not too lately. I think I usually have him on around June he does a vigil for the American University speech, right?
What I was going to announce, that his documentary, The Searchers, is now available for free on Vimeo.
Okay, we'll have to find and make a link for that.
Yeah, all right, that's very much worth watching. And you emailed me this thing about how the family of Malcolm X is filing a lawsuit against the FBI, CIA, and NYPD what they're going to argue. And by the way, this is always the way I looked at the Malcolm X case, is that they let it happen. You know, when I was doing my work on this for Pro Magazine and my book, The Assassinations, that's the way I looked at this crime, that the FBI, the CIA, and the NYPD watched it happen, and they had advanced knowledge that it was going to happen. Have you ever had Carl Evans on?
I don't recall Carl.
He wrote the book, The Judas Factor, which most people believe is the best book on the Malcolm X case. And that's pretty much what he argues also. But he goes a step further, and he says Malcolm X knew it was going to happen. Okay? So anyway, this should be an interesting lawsuit as it goes up the ladder. Now, one of the things I should talk about, because I don't think I've talked about this, is the 60th anniversary of the Warren Report. We all know that the 26 volumes were published in November of 1964, which was 2 months after the Warren Report was issued. Now, let's just think about this. September 27th, 1964, the Warren Report, all 888 pages, were handed to Johnson and then released to the public. It was handed to Johnson on the 24th, released to the public on the 27th. Now, the people who have read it, like me and you, understand that the vast majority of the footnotes in the 888 pages refer to materials that were not published yet, because they refer to the testimony and evidence that's going to be in the 26 volumes. But those were not published until 2 months later. So the 60th anniversary of the publication of 26 volumes is coming up very soon. in about a week. All right. Now, here's my question. That being the case, how did CBS and NBC broadcast specials on the Warren Report on the date it was issued to the public? Let me repeat that again. How did CBS and NBC broadcast specials on the Warren Report on the date it was issued to the public? Well, obviously, there had to be leaks. In other words, the Warren Commission was in cahoots with the media in order to get their message across and powerfully. So what happened is, and by the way, with the example of CBS, which is the worst of all, Bernie Birnbaum, who was the producer of the CBS special, he was working with the Warren Commission not a couple days or 3 days in advance. He was working with them for weeks in advance, cooperating very closely. And Mark Lane and ML D'Antonio were allowed to see outtakes from the CBS special. And they claimed that CBS rehearsed witnesses to go along with what they said in the Warren Commission. All right. In other words, there'd be a take two if they didn't like take one. But anyway, CBS did a two-hour program and NBC did a one-hour program. The NBC show was hosted by Frank McGee and Tom Pettit. All right. The CBS special was hosted by Cronkite with Dan Rather. All right. Now, here's my question. Isn't this a violation of journalistic ethics? I think it really is. When you, behind the scenes, cooperate with a government entity in order to get out the message the government entity wants to, how is that serving the public? All right. All right. Now, what happened with CBS, this wonderful journalist named Florence Graves, who published the Washington Journalism Review, she did an article in 1978. This is how in bed CBS was with the Warren Commission. They allowed the Warren Commission to recommend witnesses to place on the program. All right, that's how bad it was. CBS, when they found out what D'Antonio and Lane had discovered, they now reversed the policy, saying they would not sell them outtakes. So in other words, CBS understood what happened, and they decided they weren't going to have this exposed with their own evidence. All right, I'll give you an example. Howard Brennan, one of the worst witnesses the Warren Commission had, who refused to testify to the House Select Committee, was not in on the initial interviews that CBS did, okay? Then the Warren Commission requested that he be interviewed. And so what happened? CBS flies him into New York from Texas, and they did an interview just in time to meet the deadline. All right, let me quote Mark Lane on this. For millions of Americans, the program provided as reliable a view of the issues as would a glance at the visible portion of an iceberg reveal its true mass and shape to an inexperienced observer. So in other words, CBS didn't know they were running into a giant iceberg and they were the Titanic, but that's what happened. Now, CBS would not give their outtakes to the House Select Committee either, even if they had a subpoena, okay? This, again, was a reversal of their policy because prior to this, they did sell outtakes. ML D'Antonio bought outtakes on the McCarthy hearings from CBS. But this is how humiliated they were. All right, now, if it was just the broadcast media, that would be one thing. But it was also the print media, New York Times, Life Magazine. All right, 24 hours after Oswald was killed by Jack Ruby, the Times had a headline saying, President's assassin shot to death in jail corridor by a Dallas citizen. Now, is that amazing or what? The guy never had a chance to even have an attorney. He always proclaimed his innocence. 24 hours after he's dead, the New York Times says the president's assassin shot to death in jail corridor by a Dallas citizen. Jack Ruby was one heck of a citizen, wasn't he? Now, 4 months before the report was issued, Anthony Lewis did a preview of its contents on the first page of the Times. Beyond that, just a few days after the commission volumes were published, the Times issued a compendium of this testimony, their own version of it, in a paperback book called The Witnesses. Lewis wrote the introduction for that book. He was their guy on the Warren Report, Anthony Lewis. And he never went, he's one of the guys who attacked Oliver Stone's movie when it came out in 1991. Now, Life magazine purchases the Zapruder film, keeps it from the American public for 12 years. They swept into Dallas and they went ahead and they got Margarita and Marina and they stored them at a big time hotel room. Later on, the custody was switched over to the Secret Service. All right. Then it wasn't just that they would not show the Zapruder film. They wrote an article saying, because the problem was, if the neck wound was an entrance wound, which is what Malcolm Perry said that day, how the heck could that happen if Oswald was behind him, if he was behind Kennedy? Well, Life magazine wrote a deceptive article saying that the film showed Kennedy turning his body far around to the right as he waved somebody in the crowd. And that's how Oswald went ahead and shot him from the front. Now, this had to be a deliberate lie. And so anyway, that's how they tried to explain this. So in other words, not only did they keep the Zapruder film from the public, they then misrepresented it, right? There was no examination of when the Warren Commission volumes were published, which was 2 months later. These guys, the Times, Life magazine, CBS, NBC, did not go back and reexamine the evidence. They didn't, which is really kind of nutty, because the people who did, like Vincent Salandria, he immediately wrote one of the most powerful and one of the most enlightening essays for that time. And that was The Magical Journey of CE-399, all right? And I think Vince did that in 64, all right? So why couldn't CBS do it? Why couldn't the New York Times do it? And the Warren Commission knew, of course, Arlen Specter and Norman Redlich, just how much they needed CE-399. Because both men admitted that without CE-399, without the magic bullet, there's a conspiracy. And so this is why they were so vulnerable on this. And this is why I believe that the media covered up for them, all right? Now, if CE-399 was a plant, of course, then you now had a pre-planned upper-level conspiracy. And in fact, I believe that Arlen Specter knew this because of the way he handled Daryl Tomlinson, the guy who, along with O.P. Wright, they first discovered the so-called magic bullet on a gurney off an elevator as Tomlinson was going to the bathroom. Now, in the Warren Report, this is what it says. Although Tomlinson was not certain whether the bullet came from the Conley stretcher or an adjacent one, the commission has concluded that the bullet came from the governor's stretcher. That conclusion is buttressed by evidence which eliminated President Kennedy's stretcher as a source of the bullet. That is one, you know, the Warren Report is full of what I like to call BS paragraphs, you know, a whole paragraph that is absolutely malarkey. This is one of them. When Tink Thompson published his book, 6 Seconds in Dallas, he spent 10 pages on this issue, including diagrams, including a microscopic analysis of the evidence. There's no way in the world that that bullet was found on Connolly's stretcher. And Tink proves by a pretty convincing case that it was found on a young boy named Ronnie Fuller on his stretcher. In other words, the conspirators didn't even get the right gurney. All right. Now, after this analysis, Thompson wrote in his footnotes, and this was really one of the most powerful statements written by the first generation critics. CE-399 must have been switched for the real bullet sometime later in the transmission chain. This could have been done only by some federal officer, since it was in government possession from that time on. If this is true, then the assassination conspiracy would have had to involve members of the federal government and been an inside job. That's 1967. Today, and by the way, that was prophetic, of course, because today we know that is what happened, all right, with the work that Gary Aguilar and Tink did on the FBI guy, Bardwell Odom. You know, when they call him up and they say, this FBI memo says you showed CE-399 to O.P. Wright and Daryl Tomlinson. And Odom right off the bat says, I never showed that bullet to anybody. So the FBI just made this up because they needed it. And Spector either fell for it or he went along with it. All right. Now, how about this? The Warren Report never mentioned the most startling aspect of the Zapruder film, namely that at 3:13, Kennedy's entire body rockets backward, that with such force that it bounces off the back of the limousine. So now, in addition to having a front neck wound, you have this evidence in the Zapruder film indicating a frontal shot, all right? Now, here's my question. Why didn't Anthony Lewis go to Time Life and ask to see the Zapruder film? To my knowledge, he never did that, all right? And then, of course, there was the November 22nd conference by Kemp Clark and Malcolm Perry. Now, that was so damaging to the official story, namely that the neck wound was an entrance wound and that Kennedy had a large wound in the rear of his skull. And this is the afternoon of the assassination. That Doug Horn discovered working for the ARB that when the Warren Commission requested a transcript of that press conference, James Rowley of the Secret Service, one of the biggest cover-up artists in this whole case, said they did not have one, a transcript, which was a lie. Because the ARB found out that they did have a transcript. It was received on November 26, 1963, and Rowley had it on his desk. This is how bad this case got. And this is how bad the New York Times was, along with Life, CBS, and NBC. All this stuff, you didn't really have to do a lot of digging, but they didn't want to do it. So what I'm saying here, of course, is that by the release of the Warren Report in September of 1964, there was enough evidence to disprove its operating underlying concepts, namely that Oswald was a lone assassin, all the shots came from behind, and that there was fraud in the evidence trail. I mean, a very good indication, of course, is that O.P. Wright's name is not in the Warren Report. Let me repeat that. O.P. Wright's name is not in the Warren Report. Now, that's amazing, because that had to be deliberate, because you're not going to tell me Spector didn't know how important O.P. Wright was. He was in charge of the medical and ballistics evidence. If he interviewed Tomlinson, how could he not know about O.P. Wright? Because Tomlinson is the guy that called in O.P. Wright and gave him the bullet. And then it was O.P. Wright that gave the Secret Service the bullet. I think the evidence is overwhelming that Spector did know. And the reason that this was covered up was not revealed until Edward Epstein, about a half century after he learned of the facts, finally revealed what Spector had to say about this. And it's in our book, The JFK Assassination Chokeholds. This is what he said. These are Spector's words. I showed them the Zapruder film frame by frame and explained that they could either accept a single bullet theory or begin looking for a second assassin. Let me repeat that again. I showed them the Zapruder film frame by frame and explained that they could either accept a single bullet theory or begin looking for a second assassin. In other words, the Warren Commission did not want to do that. So they went along with this impossible idea of the magic bullet. All right, and this is how we got stuck with an 888-page report of malarkey and the 26 volumes that do not really support it. All right? By the way, Spector also said this to Epstein. Well, why didn't the Secret Service come up with that when they did their recreations? This is what Spector said. They had no idea at the time that unless one bullet hit Kennedy and Connally, there had to be a second assassin. Do you believe that? Do you believe that? That's what Spector said. And Epstein kept hidden for over 50 years. Now, in addition to no O.P. Wright in the Warren Report, there is no mention of Siebert and O'Neill, the two FBI agents who were at the autopsy that night. And this is for good reason. All right. When Siebert was interviewed for the book In the Eye of History by William Matson Law, this is what he said. If they went in there and asked us to pinpoint where the bullet entered the back and the measurement and all that stuff, how are you going to work it? See, the way they got the single bullet theory was by moving that back wound up to the base of the neck. When he was then asked to repeat what he thought about the subject, Siebert said, you can't put enough sugar on it for me to bite it. The bullet was too low in the back. All right. And when he was asked about Spectre, he said, "What a liar. I feel he got his orders from above. How far above, I don't know." So in other words, there's no Siebert and O'Neill in the Warren Report. There's no O.P. Wright in the Warren Report. All right. And I think there's a good reason for that. And then, of course, there's the case of George Berkeley. Now, there was a death certificate signed by Berkeley, which located the back wound at the third thoracic vertebra, which is about 5 inches below the neckline. That is not in the Warren Report. There is no deposition by Berkeley in the Warren Report. All right, when I asked, I think this was in 64 or 65, by the Kennedy Library, if he agreed with the Warren Report on the number of bullets that entered JFK's body, he replied with this: "I would not care to be quoted on that." All right. Now, I believe that any serious news organization, if they would have investigated this case, would have found that the Warren Commission was full of crap. And this is why both investigations were canceled. All right. Both by the New York Times. That was one of them. I think Harrison Salisbury put the kibosh on that. All right. Peter Kiss, one of the people who knew the guys at the New York Times, says that they were making very good progress at exposing that the Warren Commission was full of crap. All right. And by the way, you know, one of the things they were investigating, it was David Ferry and the trips that Ferry took to Dallas. And if he had access to an airport there. And then the guy at the Life magazine put the kibosh and it was Holland McCombs. And we know, of course, Holland McCombs was a close friend of Clay Shaw. And then he retired the two best investigators that Life magazine had, Tink Thompson and Ed Kern. And I don't even think that those two guys knew that he actually kept on the other people, including Dick Billings. But he retired those two guys. And so Tink took his stuff and he wrote his book, 6 Seconds in Dallas. All right. Now, I think probably one of the most revealing things to show just how bad that the Warren Commission was, and something I think that could have been discovered if they really wanted to, was the association of Wesley Liebler and Sylvie Odio. Sylvie Odio, I don't have to tell you who she is. She's one of the most important witnesses there is. All right. But when she was interviewed by Gate and Fonzie, January 16th, 1976, is when the report was dated. And it was not declassified until 20 years later due to the ARB. In that interview, Fonzie talked to Odio about her sighting of this guy named Leon Oswald, all right, at her apartment door in late September of 1963, which would be very, very interesting to say the least, because if he's there, then how was he on the bus down to Mexico City? Well, it would be one indication that there was an impersonator, isn't it? All right, and we know how credible she was, because she fainted when she saw the picture of Oswald on TV. They had to take her to a hospital and give her smelling salts. Plus, she had her corroborating witness, her sister. And there were three people she wrote to about the event before the assassination. So the implication is that the Cuban exiles were setting up Oswald in advance. So Odio told Gate and Fonzie that after she was questioned for the commission, Liebler asked to take her out to dinner. And during the dinner, Liebler kept threatening her with a polygraph test. And after that, Liebler said to her, and this is a direct quote from Gate and Fonzie's report, "Well, you know, if we do find out that this is a conspiracy, you know that we have orders from Chief Justice Warren to cover this thing up." Again, let me repeat that. Odio to Fonzie: "Well, you know, if we do find out that this is a conspiracy, you know we have orders from Chief Justice Warren to cover this thing up." Fonzie couldn't believe it. You know, and he said, "Come on, Liebler really said that?" And Odio replied with, "Yes, sir, I would swear on that." Now, that's a really astonishing piece of evidence that we had to wait till the 1990s to find out about it, because it was classified. one more thing here and to conclude this piece I wrote. Everyone knows that Warren Commission Exhibit 3120 is the pamphlet called The Crime Against Cuba, written by Corliss Lamont. All right, and that Oswald was handing this out, except his copy was from the first edition in 1961, but he was publishing, he was printing, he was handing it out in 1963. And by that time, it had gone through five different editions. And the CIA had ordered 45 copies of it back in 1961. And you will see on that document, 544 Camp Street, FPCC, New Orleans. Just look in volume 26, page 783. Now, how was it possible that the Warren Commission didn't know the significance of that address? Why did it have to fall to Jim Garrison to go down to that address and find out its very interesting location? The other address it had, 531 Lafayette, which the FBI used to disguise that it was Guy Bannister's associates investigators. Now, why on earth would Oswald put that address on that pamphlet? And why would he pay guys from the unemployment office to help him leaflet? Because there wasn't any other members in the FPCC in New Orleans. And Garrison said that this was the first indication to him that Oswald wasn't a communist, that he was really an agent provocateur, and that the FBI was trying to cover this up. Now, we know today from a number of witnesses that Oswald was in Bannister's office, including two INS agents. We also know that Guy Bannister was very upset when he learned about this, that Oswald had used his office address on the pamphlet. But it wasn't until a long time later that we found out something else. The right-hand man for Clay Shaw was a guy named Jesse Corr at the International Trademark. He just happened to be on the street when Oswald was, I think that was Canal Street, when Oswald was leafleting that flyer. Follow this very closely. He picked one of the flyers up and he noticed the Camp Street address. He drew an arrow to that address and attached a message to it, the arrow. Note the inside back cover. He then mailed it to the FBI. Now, does that tell you just about everything you need to know about New Orleans? All right. Because it was Jesse Corr who summoned the TV cameras to the trademark when Oswald was there a few days later. And we also know, of course, that it was Carlos Bringuier, through his go-between guy, Quiroga, who gave Oswald the flyers to hand out that day. Now, some of the reporters at the local TV station, WDSU, they've even said that when they came into work that morning, the morning that Oswald was at the ITM, that it was already on the agenda. That shows you what the heck was happening in New Orleans. So the question then becomes, how could the FBI not known about this? And the answer to that question is they did know. And any enterprising reporter or team of reporters could have found this out. Now, we know the Warren Commission hearings were closed to the public, and Mark Lane wanted to be the lawyer for Marguerite Oswald. J. Lee Rankin would not hear of it. He ended up being a witness. He was the only witness who complained about why his appearance was not open to the public. And so he forced open his hearing. Now, can anybody imagine something like that happening today with the way the media behaves about everything today? But it wasn't any enterprising reporter for the New York Times or Life magazine or CBS or NBC who exposed the Warren Commission for what it was. It was private citizens who actually went ahead and read the volumes, compared them to the Warren Report, and found out that, wait a minute, these guys made conclusions in spite of the evidence, not because of it. All right, so it was people like Harold Weisberg, Tink Thompson, Sylvia Marr, and Mark Lane, who actually looked up the footnotes that the Warren Report had in them and discovered that it was an elaborate fraud, okay? Now, what's the sum of this is that this began the collapse of the American people's belief in their government. And as Kevin Phillips wrote in his book, Arrogant Capital, he has a chart on this. When Kennedy took office, it was 75%. By the 1990s, it was down to 19%. The biggest first year drop was in 1964. All right. And there's one last thing I need to comment on this issue, because I don't think this was reported by anyone either. 3 months after the Warren Commission volumes were released, Johnson sent the first combat troops to Vietnam. And as far as I know, no journalist ever made the connection between those two events happening. And they really, really should have. All right. Let me Barbara said that I should comment on this. She's one of our most loyal listeners. All right. And she actually sent me some information that there were some media outlets like the Columbus Dispatch and Shore Local Magazine, a New Jersey publication, all right, that actually did commemorate this. And she also adds, I always had a different interpretation of this April 27th, 1964 memo to Lee Rankin than you had. You had discussed it on an old show with Len. You were disturbed that the single bullet theory was still being discussed and not investigated at the stage of the investigation. I thought Redlich was determined that if the commission were going to hang their case on it, they must test it out. Now, I think the subsequent actions that occurred were an indication the commission did not care if their theory was true. They had a plausible theory and wanted to leave it at that. After Redlich's April memo, he was denounced on the Congress floor during the month of May 1964 several times. That's something I didn't know. How did they know about that? The newspapers as well attacked him for his membership in the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee, which offered legal assistance. Oh, because they thought he was too much of a leftist. Okay, which offered legal assistance to persons appearing before the HUAC, House Un-Americans Activities. Redlich also had issues because he participated in civil rights cases and Cuba issues. He was a man condemned for his causes. And she's right in this next paragraph. She says, there was actually a meeting if he should be removed from the commission on May the 19th, 1964, because of this publicity. Redlich was only safe from dismissal by Earl Warren. Most commissioners would not have hired Redlich if they knew his employment history. Some wanted to let him go, and several other lawyers needed to leave in June to hide that issue. Ed Morrow reportedly said during the McCarthy period, during a staff meeting questioning, if anyone had communist connections, the terror is right here in this room. And so it was with that commission. The commission felt the report was on shaky grounds and they had a suspect employee. Their report could not stand on the merit of their work alone. Your article caused me to read the HSCA interview of Redlich. I believe he misled the HSCA. They asked him if he was pressured by anyone. He denied it. But I think any reasonable person would have seen the actions of the congressmen and senators, the newspaper articles, and the commission meetings as an attempt at intimidation. If not of Redlich himself, then of the commissioners. It was a possible blacklisting of Redlich by the majority of the commissioners. And yet when the HSCA asked if anyone tried to pressure him, he denies it. If the HSCA didn't think it was, why did they even pose the question? And why didn't they question Redlich more specifically on these activities of the media, the Congress, and his employers, namely the commission? I believe that his affiliations were just a cover to get Redlich off the committee before he might have raised other suspicious lapses of the report. Redlich never did raise any more after that. Okay, was it because he learned his lesson? Redlich never took any of his work product home, according to his testimony. He left everything, unlike most of the other senior staff. Did that have any significance? There was also mention of Redlich's memo concerning Marina. A Mr. Sawyer asked Redlich to clarify Marina's actions in Washington. Redlich replies, "Do you wish to be enlightened on the record? I will be pleased to answer." This threw Sawyer for a loop. Sawyer had an off-the-record conversation with counsel who was not identified. So this Marina Oswald memo of February 28, 1964, was the first troubling memo Redlich wrote. Redlich testified he gave a lengthy document on guidelines for questioning Marina to Rankin. Mr. Klein, who was the HSCA lawyer, said they couldn't find it. The document would have contained Marina's previous answers to the questions for comparison. So what did Marina do in Washington? Redlich really questioned who the real Marina Oswald was. He believed she was a created image. He questioned her role in Oswald's life. I know Redlich created the outline for the Warren Commission report of Oswald as the assassin, but it had to be approved by higher-ups who could have raised, including a search for other suspects or accomplices. Well, that's pretty interesting. And she asked me, you know, my thoughts on this. Well, first of all, I knew this stuff, but it kind of came down the memory hole. There was a lot of pressure on the Warren Commission to get rid of Redlich. That's true. And I guess if you want to, you can take a look at this through the other side of the telescope. That maybe by all this McCarthyite questioning of his loyalties, all right, he was more or less subdued after that April 27th, 1964 memo, all right, which, you know, might have been his way of trying to actually say, maybe we should think twice about this CE-399, all right, you know. So that's an interesting, that's really an interesting point of view. I have to give her a lot of credit for that, all right. Redlich was a pretty liberal guy, all right. He was one of the more liberal people that that worked for the commission, all right. And so they might have perceived that later as a mistake, all right. And so this whole thing about raising a ruckus about him and the Emergency Civil Liberties Union and all that stuff, that might have been a way to batten the hatches. So that's a very interesting look at this, which I hadn't thought about, all right? So it's always good to have listeners like that on your side. Okay, I have a couple of other questions, which I think we've been going for quite a while, all right? So I think that's enough for tonight, and I'll get to the other ones the next time.
Okay, sure, right.
I promise I will, so.
Yeah, and then you're going to give us a report of how the Dallas conference went this year then, right?
Right, the virtual conference, right.
Right.
And I really recommend that everybody tune in for that, okay? It's going to be a real good one, okay? All right, so that's it for tonight then, Lynn. Thank you so much.
All right, and thank you, and good. We'll keep in touch.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, good night.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment, we're speaking to Mr. John Barber from Las Vegas, Nevada. Hello, John.
Oh, Len, it's such a delight to talk to you. You are absolutely one of my favorite human beings, not only because you're just such a terrific person, but you are an enormous talent. I mean, you play the guitar as well as anybody, and you've made enormous, enormous contributions to the definitive film on the murder of John Kennedy, which is called The American Media in the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. So, and most of all, I love being in your home. You're the only person, I get lots of invites to stay in homes. You're the only person from whom I take that invite because I just love you and Susan, and then I used to love her father.
Well, thanks. And, you know, when we first kind of met, I think it was 4th of July, maybe 2015, and when I went to visit you, and I did make a short film of that trip, and that was a really good interview as well. And then recently, we worked together on something for William Pepper. That was good. So I, you know, anytime you're doing something, I'm happy to contribute. And it's good that we both know the topic and we're both coming from the same place of we had admired, well, Jim Garrison and Fletcher Prouty and maybe Mae Brussel. And, you know, and we just talk about the good and the bad, the pros and the cons. And I guess today I'm happy to promote that you're doing something special for this November 22nd anniversary of the assassination. Imagine that the assassination of a president and the government still won't release files, and it's taken it up to concerned citizens such as yourself to speak up and do something. So I want to help promote what you've got planned. So maybe you can let people know what's on the agenda here, horizon.
Yeah, and you know, one of the really sad things is a number of people voted for Trump because RFK Jr. was involved with them, and they said it was the first time that they heard publicly from Trump and RFK Jr. that they were going to open the files, which is an absolute crock, and I'll tell you. Why? First of all, one of the reasons Trump would never open the files is it would be a bigger story than he is. And the other reason is he had the opportunity the first time around, okay? And a guy named Jefferson Morley spent 10 years going through the courts trying to get the release of the Garrison files, not just the CIA files, more important, the Garrison files, because the Warren Commission files are supposed to be released in 1937. Garrison's 25 years later because they name the shooters, they name absolutely everything. And the judge in Washington, D.C., not only sided with the Central Intelligence Agency saying they're never going to release Garrison files, they're not going to release the CIA files. Trump concurred with that. The judge's name was Kavanaugh, and he pointed him to the Supreme Court. They are not going to release any files. And anyway, I look at it this way. Democracy was shot down in America November 22nd, 1963.
So tell me about one of your guests that are speaking. They've got a story that no one's heard.
Not only no one's heard, it will absolutely blow your mind and open your mind. It is a story about the relationship between Jane Mansfield and Jim Garrison, which led to the murder of Jane Mansfield. When you hear that story, you are going to be knocked out. And of course, you probably know that Wayne Manson, before John Kennedy Jr. was killed or murdered in his small airplane crash. He was interviewed by John Jr. exactly 3 months before the date that he was murdered in his plane.
Wayne Madsen did the interview?
No, Wayne Madsen was interviewed by John Jr. along with two other investigative journalists by John Jr. to investigate the murder of his father. And then he was going to publish it in his magazine called George, which was not named because of George Washington, but because of the guy who thought engineered the murder of his father. He was going to use that as a platform to run for the Senate. And that's why the oligarchs had to get rid of another Kennedy. And this story also ties in with Dorothy Kilgallen. Because Dorothy Kilgallen was the only person to get an interview with Jack Ruby. And then she said publicly, I'm going to blow this story wide open. And she traveled around with what she had written in a folder. That folder ended up in Jane Mansfield's hands. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about
that. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so with Wayne Madsen, you guys are going to be discussing this November 22nd on your show.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
And then Chris Hedges, who I thought and still think is one of the brightest men in America, and you should check out his YouTubes about the election. They're brilliant. But in any event, I also did a show called Talking Movies, and you were on a couple of them when we were talking about the movies that were made about the assassination from executive action on the 16th story, and supposedly Forrestal jumped out and committed suicide. And when I sat with Mr. Garrison, I put him on camera for 3.5 hours, and every once in a while then he would stop and he would say, John, I never, never speculate. So turn off the cameras, don't record this. And he had this bizarre sense of humor. He said the reason they called Forrestal a suicide because he couldn't hang on to the wrists of the guys who were tossing him out the window. He also predicted that America was going to become what Reagan called the Soviet Union, the evil empire, which indeed it has become, and even worse. And then he was just amazing because Truman, on his deathbed, said the worst thing he ever did is create this security state. So Garrison said that with that as a background, he said, look at this. There was no reason to drop an A-bomb on Hiroshima. All that Truman had to do was, there were a lot of little islands off the coast, that just say, hey, take a look at this little island. We're going to evaporate it. And we have another one in store if you don't sign a peace treaty. No, he went ahead and dropped the bomb over the objections of the guys who created the bomb. And then he dropped a second bomb. And Garrison said that wasn't to stop the Japanese. That was to warn the Russians. There was nobody smarter on the planet than Jim Garrison, and nobody more dedicated to the cause. And a lot like your friend, you know, your friend Oliver Stone, who made that brilliant, brilliant movie, JFK. He has said publicly he's sorry he made the film. And he's sorry because he's shocked that he cannot make a movie again in Hollywood. He can't get the money to do that. Well, Garrison had the same feelings. He solved the case in 1967 when he arrested Lee Harvey Oswald, and he said he never fired a shot. The paraffin tests prove it. He wasn't even on the sixth floor. And he was shocked when he discovered all the things he shocked. And, you know, he wasn't after Clay Shaw for conspiracy. I mean, that was the primary case. His primary case was perjury, and he lost, of course, the conspiracy case. But in 7 minutes, he got a conviction for the perjury case. He had 87 witnesses who saw Clay Shaw with Lee Harvey Oswald and David Ferry. Unbelievable. And the other kinds of things that were so, but that was all turned down by the FBI. And then what happened is that's why the movie is called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, because Dan Rather and Walter Cronkite and CBS played a major role before the murder, he said, in spreading and spreading the fiction before reality sets in. So some of the stuff that people are going to see and hear are just in this 2-hour live special. I'm going to open it up to phone calls also.
All right. Now, John, where can people log in and find this?
Well, I'm having a rehearsal Wednesday night. I'll ask Don Newsom, who is going to be directing your show from Texas. They've moved to Texas after being flooded out and fired out in California. Isn't that amazing? And they're just doing enormously well. They have guys who work for the government who have very successful shows on their network.
Okay, yeah, get me a link so I can put this, because this show will air Thursday, and then that gives people time to for the 22nd, for that's when you're going live, right?
Yeah, that's when we're going to go live.
All right.
I must tell you, Len, I love live. With the help of people like you and Brian Lloyd and a dozen others, we ended up making the two most definitive documentaries ever about the murder of John Kennedy. And we will be showing a couple of the very most important clips from that documentary on this 2 hours live.
Okay, good. Good luck with everything, John. I'm happy to promote it and make links for you. So thank you for taking time to talk about it, and I hope this helps promotion of it.
Len, I cannot thank you enough. I mean, you're just You're an absolute treasure of talent and friendship. And there's nobody, there are very few human beings like you, believe me.
Okay, all right, okay. Thank you, John. Okay, thanks. We'll keep in touch, buddy.
We certainly will. Bye-bye. Okay.